Welcome to the Abundant Yoga Teacher Podcast. My name's Amy McDonald. I'm a yoga teacher, yoga student, and a yoga business coach. And I'm here to support you to share your yoga with the people in your community who really need it. So if you're an amazing yoga teacher, but you sometimes struggle with the business part of what it is that you do, you're in the right place. I hope you thoroughly enjoy everything I've got in store for you. And if you have any suggestions, questions, or ideas for future podcasts, reach out to me on Instagram at Amy Yoga Biz Coach. Hey there, welcome to the Abundant Yoga Teacher Podcast. I hope you're doing great. Today's topic is, the title is Four Anecdotes from the Forest Season Finale. And here's a public service announcement. This might not be the most uplifting episode I've ever recorded. In fact, it's not going to be. So, you know, I just want to, just for some community listening safety, you know, this might not be one that you get through in full, but it is going to be a fairly frank and candid reflection on all things yoga land, in at least in my exposure to them currently, and what the hell we do with all of that information. It's an interesting time, hey? It's a really interesting time in yoga land for sure. And so I'm going to be running through four anecdotes and not really having a solution for any of them other than just to propose them as considerations and mull them over. I suspect they may be conversation starters. Before that, some housekeeping things. Today you need to get yourself registered for Keep Growing Mastermind, today or tomorrow at the very latest, because we have our first coaching call for the year, Wednesday morning, that's Melbourne time, or Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening, depending on where you are in the world. So if you've been thinking about signing up, if you've applied and you haven't registered yet, that's the timeline on that one. Link is in the episode notes for the Keep Growing Mastermind. Welcome to my new Patreon supporters, Rosemary Booker, Sarah Bargigian, Sarah Truman, and Sundara Yoga. Thanks, ladies, for supporting the show. And there's some great bonus content coming out this month. The book and film club for all of you Patreon supporters for February, because we've just had the January one and it was super fun. The movie we will be watching and then discussing early February is Iyengar, The Man, Yoga, The Student's Journey, and you can rent it on, I've rented it on YouTube, but Patricia says she rented it on Amazon and it cost her the big $2.99. So there you go, that's $2.99. So that's what's coming up for Book and Film Club. Thank you to everybody who supports me on Patreon. You know, I spent it today the proof may not be in the pudding as it happens, I have actually spent hours today reading and preparing for this pod and a couple of others that are going to launch us into next season. And I was thinking as I was doing this that it's because of the people who support the show on Patreon that I can actually afford to take more time in the reading and the researching and the following up with academics, et cetera, et cetera. So really, it's flattering to have you all supporting my Patreon page. And it also is, just from a logistical perspective, it really is enabling, does help me make hope. Like I said, maybe not this episode. Theoretically, it does mean that I can take more time to do more research and bring you better, more considered information, but let's see how we go. All right, so welcome to the season finale of the Abundant Yoga Teacher Podcast. I think this is season freaking 8. Here's four anecdotes from the forest. All right, so if you're sort of new to me, or maybe a bit more new to yoga mythology, let's quickly talk about what the forest is, because like I said at the top of the episode, you know, this one might not be the most uplifting podcast you've heard in a while. When I talk about the forest, generally what I'm talking about is when we're going into the the murky or the unknown or the concealed parts of who we are or what we do, the more animal nature, if you like. If we compare the forest to the city where there is culture, in the forest there is nature, true nature. And so sometimes I'll refer to being in the forest as times when things seem unclear or confusing or obfuscated. We can't see a clear way forward. We can't see through the jungle. And so this is where we're going again. This is my very last warning. If you don't want to come into the forest with me, if you want to stay out there in the city, in culture versus nature, all good. I'll see you next season. All right, so let's look at my first anecdote of four. And this is a theme that we're going to get into more in season 9 and certainly in the bonus episodes on Patreon. When we start to look at the marketing of yoga, and I'm working on some pieces at the moment. They're not quite ready yet, but essentially about when does marketing become immoral? What should we be looking out for, and what should we do about it when we see it, or when we inadvertently do it ourselves? Last week, I was contacted by a colleague who had received an Instagram message from someone that she didn't know, who was offering her a complimentary session. Actually, you know what? I'm just going to read it to you because I think this stuff is important. Let me pull it up. So she messaged me to say, hey, do you know what this is about and what should we do with it? And my initial reaction was, you know what, just leave it. But in thinking it over, actually, and in talking it over with one of my beautiful yoga friends, we came to the conclusion that actually this is unethical in a number of fronts. So here we go. Here's the message that my colleague was sent. Hey, person. I'm not going to disclose her name. I hope you're doing well. I came across your page via Amy Yoga Biz Coach and wanted to reach out. Smiley emoji. I'm currently in the process of interviewing yogi entrepreneurs like yourself as a way to gain insight into how I can best serve and support you to achieve your goals. It goes on. That's the screenshot that I have. So in talking with my colleague about how she came to receive this message, what we concluded was this particular new yoga business coach, I'm not going to name them because that would be punching down. Not much. I've got 12,500 followers. It's not like I'm bloody Joe Rogan out here. They've got, you know, a quarter of that. So I'm not going to punch down. I'm not going to name them. But what it appears to be happening is that they're going through my follower, the people who are following me on Instagram, and reaching out to them and proposing, to do an interview. Now, I don't know this. I'm speculating after working in the coaching industry since 2012. That's 10 years. I'm speculating that this is part of a sales funnel to have someone have a free interview, make friends, build rapport, and then work into a sales pitch. That's what it sounds like to me. I don't know for sure, and my colleague doesn't either because she's not interested in following it up. At first, like I said, I thought, you know what, they can do that. Access to my followers is in the public domain. It's within the functionality of the app. I mean, I don't want to hustle that hard. It feels a bit icky to me, but okay. If anything, the bit about it that I felt unethical about was to be, I don't want to be patronizing to any of you, But maybe not everybody's going to read that message like I did and go, oh, hell, this is a soft sell. This is the thin end of the wedge in a pretty intense, pretty hard marketing hustle. I see that because I've been in the coaching industry for a long time, and you get taught, if you're doing any type of coaching certification, you will get taught how to sell and how to sell hard. Doesn't feel nice. I don't do it, but I know how. The dark arts, as one of my former clients would have probably called it. And so my concern, if any, when I first read this message was, I don't feel good about that because the people that they're sending that to might not appreciate that this is what that is. And I know so many of you probably, all you regular listeners would probably give up a half an hour of your time because you want to help out another fellow yogini, right? Well, I got a half an hour. If it could help you, sure, I can give you some of my time. And you could end up in a coercive sales conversation. So that's the bit that that ruffled my feathers. But in talking about this message with another friend, what also became clear was that this message suggests that I, Amy, am somehow endorsing this particular outfit. Let me read it again. Hey, such and such. I hope you're doing well. I came across your page via Amy Yoga Biz Coach and wanted to reach out. So I'm interpreting this, because I don't know who these people are, as that they're hunting down my followers. But this could be read as though I've recommended this business reach out to that person that they've messaged. And that is also unethical. It implies imprimatur from me. It implies my endorsement, whereas I don't know who these people are. They've never connected with me. We've never had any sort of, I don't know anything about them, other than I got sent this screenshot from someone who got sent the original message. And so, you know, this first anecdote really, it's really bringing home to me my, you know, I've never felt comfortable with unethical marketing, but I'm just feeling that heightened more and more and more. And I'm just no longer available for bullshit and unethical marketing in either of the two industries that I straddle, both of which are prone to it. So I'm talking about yoga and I'm talking about business coaching. I was listening to Life After MLM, which is Roberta Blevins' podcast. If you've watched the LuLaRoe four-part, I think, docuseries, she's interviewed on that. She's got a podcast that I enjoy listening to from time to time. And this episode I was listening to this morning, she was talking about, with a guest, she was talking about business coaches, specifically in the MLM industry. And I was sipping my coffee and working on some other project while I was writing. But the whole time I was kind of, I had this low-level anxiety, like, what about if she calls me out? What about, like, is the whole business coaching industry skeezy as hell? I'm nervous about being associated with some of these really shitty practices. One of the examples that her guest mentioned was a coach who was selling a program on how to make a program, who sold the program. And the anecdote goes, again, this is like fourth hand, not my anecdote, go listen to the podcast, A Life After MLM. But the woman who bought this program, she then saw that particular coach go on to sell it a second time and used the amount of money she made the first time she sold it in the marketing of the second time she sold it, even though the participant in the program understood that only one person had actually made a profit as a result of taking the program. So this sort of stuff is just outrageous, unethical bullshit. And as someone who works in this industry, both the coaching and the yoga industry, it gets bloody disheartening, you know. It gets really disheartening. And I know, you know, maybe you're listening in and you're also feeling this rub between knowing what your competitors are doing. And, you know, in general, I don't like that phrase, but I'm going to lean into it. Did I mention that this is not going to be a positive episode? I'm going to lean into it for a moment, because that's what my competitors are doing, that shit. They're using statistics that are dubious. They're using heavily biased success examples that aren't representative of the whole. They're relentlessly pursuing my clientele that I have worked my ass off to build over time. And this is just the stuff that I know about, because I've got a few moles, you know, that are feeding me information. Good, who knows what else is going on? Now, I'm not saying that I own anybody or that they can't steal my studio. Like, I'm not doing any of that. But what I am suggesting is, it gets tiring when your competitors are doing this shit and you're not. It would be so much easier if I lent into fear or shame-based marketing strategies, but I don't want to do it. It's annoying, frustrating, demoralizing, actually, when my competitors are. They are doing it. They are doing it. And it's gross. And I'm just feeling a little bit lost in the forest. I don't want to do it, but I'm not sure what to do about the people who are doing it. In the past, I would have said, well, you know, the right people will find me and the right people will find them, except, of course, if the them is using undue influence. So I guess in a way I'm feeling this ridiculously maternal kind of duty of care, and at the same time just businesswoman to businesswoman being frustrated that people are claiming to be one thing and actually conducting themselves in quite another way. Which leads me to anecdote number two, which is about oblivious or orchestrated syncretism that is misleading at best and manipulative at worst. Okay, Amy, what the hell did you just say? That was a whole lot of nonsense and I don't know who you are anymore. Good point. Okay, so syncretism essentially is when you, not necessarily opposing, but diverse schools of thought come in together and mash themselves up, grok in on each other and kind of become a whole new thing or absorb each other, even though at their heart, they're contradictory. And you know, I see this just all the time and I'm going to give you some examples. I don't have a judgment on these ones. I do have a judgment on some of them, where they are more manipulative rather than perhaps misleading or just maybe, you know, benign altogether. So let's say, for example, I teach a half day yoga retreat, and in the middle of it, I do a cacao ceremony. Well, that's syncretism. A cacao ceremony is not yoga. Yoga is not a cacao ceremony. Vastly different traditions mashed in together. Does it matter? No. Probably, I think it's a good idea to let participants know that they're not the same thing. Like, let's not continue to perpetuate the bullshit that we might have received, right? Like, crystal healing and yoga, not the same. It's okay. You're allowed to put things together. It's like a triathlon, man. But no one's telling you that swimming is the same as running. They go quite well together. Why not? Get on your bike afterwards. You got a triathlon. But no one's saying it's all the same thing. Forget about the fact that you're in a pool. It's still running. Forget about the fact that you're on a bike. It's all running. No, it's not. It's swimming and it's biking and it's running. Triathlon, awesome. We're not trying to syncretize all of this shit in together, right? So sometimes it's oblivious. You get a brand new yoga student, comes into something. They don't know that actually, you know what? In yoga, there's not a whole lot of dance, except your jam is yoga and ecstatic dance. So we just need to pull these things apart. So people know, I like this bit, not that bit. All of that stuff, I don't have a problem with any of it, really. Whether you want to tell your people that, I don't know, taking ayahuasca is different to transcendental meditation or not, I don't care. You do you. Like, get your insurance, whatever. I'm not saying that that stuff is bad. Where this syncretism gets, again, like, Amy feeling kind of a bit adrift in what the hell am I even doing in this industry anymore, that feeling tone is when it's used in, I think, an intentionally misleading way. And so the anecdote I want to talk about, and again, this is just a collection of four anecdotes that's come across my desk this week. This is not Amy's, what am I up to now? 30, I don't know how old I've been, how long I've been, 30-some-year journey in yoga land. It's just this past week. So I'm reading here from Branding Bhakti by Nicole. Oh, my God, Nicole, I should have said your name a few times beforehand. I think it's one of those Greek ones that you need to say a few times beforehand so you get it right. Karapanagiotis. Sorry, Nicole, that was clunky. Branding Bhakti, Krishna Consciousness and the Makeover of a Movement is great. I really loved it. It's put out by Indiana University Press. You can get it on the interwebs. I'll put the details in the episode notes. So she's talking here about the premise of the book is exactly that, like how ISKCON, the Hare Krishna people, are recognizing that there is a skew in their population, that their founder, we won't go into too much, but this is a new movement really in the sense that the founder came to the United States in the late 60s to start the movement and he came at the behest of his guru, who intended that Krishna become the global religion and that Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada take the teachings of Chaitanya to the West and, you know, get the white people into it. really. That's what it was about. They started with the hippies and people coming down off drugs and whatever and sought to blow it out. Then Prabhupada in 77 made his transition. My dog is currently doing intense Kapalabhati, which I think is actually barking while dreaming. Sorry. Mildly distracted by the pumping of the abdominals of my dog. Oh, so cute. So, yes, Prabhupada, 1977, done. No great lineage succession plan. And just like the show, it all sort of turned to shittish and a lot of people went, hell no, there was murder and child abuse and other blah things. And anyway, a lot of people said, no, thank you. That's not really what I'm into. So the population shifted because, in fact, a whole lot of people, you know, Indian folks, people of Indian heritage, looking for some kind of connection to a tradition that was familiar to them, they joined ISKCON. I'm guessing, not knowing all of the blah that was going on. Anyway, what this means is that currently ISKCON's got a whole lot more people, Indian people or people of Indian descent than what they call Westerners, which I think they mean white people. Anyway, and a lot of the people in the movement say, hey, this is not what Prabhupada wanted. He wanted this to be for everybody, not just for people who already had Krishna. We need to get the whites in. Obviously, you got to read Nicole's book. And I mean, shit, I'm not going to lie. There was some very uncomfortable, highly problematic rhetoric in it, but compelling. So interesting. Anyway, one of the leaders that she's talking about in the ISKCON movement is called Radhanath Swami. And he has pursued, as a way of getting more people into ISKCON, he has pursued yoga teacher trainings, teaching yoga and offering yoga teacher trainings as a mechanism to get people into ISKCON. And I think, and I don't know, and if you're an ISKCON person, I don't want to get this wrong. I'll issue an apology if I get this wrong. I think that the chaps who do the oh my God, I'm just blanking on the name of the podcast. I was really into it. One moment. The Wisdom of the Sages podcast. I think they are part of this branch of ISKCON. But like I said, ISKCON people, if you're listening and I get that wrong, let me know. I'll happily, readily issue an apology. Anyway, so in Nicole's book, she's talking about how Radhanath Swami, in order to draw the line from yoga and yoga teacher training through to becoming an ISKCON devotee, a devotee of Prabhupada, a worshipper of Krishna, he's done a little bit of a fiddle around with the Yoga Sutra. I'm going to read this again. I'm reading from Branding Bhakti by Nicole Karapanagiotis. Sorry, Nicole. I'll put the link in the episode notes. In order to rebrand ISKCON as the heart of postural yoga, Radhanath Swami has systematized a complex theology that places Krishna as the philosophical heart of yoga's most central text, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Generally speaking, scholars of the Yoga Sutras have understood the text as embedded within the Samkhya interpretive context. Read in this light, Patanjali's yoga is a system of practices meant to reduce the fluctuations of the mind stuff, yogas citta vritti nirodha, being the famous Yoga Sutra adage. In Patanjali's yoga, this reduction or cessation of the fluctuations of the mind stuff, or more colloquially, the reduction of our mental chatter, is aimed towards the larger goal of achieving a state of objectlessness and contentlessness awareness, contentless. Or the standing of pure consciousness alone. This goal is known in yoga as samadhi. As Christopher Keechapel puts it, Patanjali defines samadhi as the collapse of distinctions between grasper, grasping, and grasped, wherein the person or witness becomes like a clear jewel. Okay, so I hope none of you are having PTSD flashbacks to your yoga teacher training, but that's kind of it, right? Like, that's where we're going here. All right, I'm skipping some bits, but... And I apologize, I know I'm reading a lot, but I'm trying to, I don't know, I'm trying to make a point. Maybe I'm not. Here we go. Nicole goes on. Although most accounts of the Yoga Sutra follow this interpretation, Radhanath Swami's conceptual brand of ISKCON rests on a different understanding of the text. In particular, Radhanath Swami holds that rather than meditation or a submission to Ishvara being a tool by which to achieve samadhi, submission to Ishvara is itself samadhi. More than this, Radhanath Swami teaches that rather than just being an idealized exemplar on which to concentrate, Ishvara from Patanjali's Yoga Sutras is none other than Krishna himself, who he sees as the source and Lord of the universe, the same God from the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavata Purana and other Vaishnava texts. All right, so if that's a lot, I'm going to give you the Amy cut down version. Patanjali, let's call it 400 CE, wrote an instruction manual for other renunciants to achieve a form of samadhi. And that is yogaschitta vritti nirodha, like the cessation of the fluctuations of the mind stuff. That's what that is. It's a manual to get outside, to get, not outside, to transcend your physical body and all of your inner shit and, you know, that's it. Go, get be absorbed. This guy who has a lot of centers and a lot of teacher trainees and a massive following is saying Patanjali is teaching us that if we chant Hare Krishna, if we devote ourselves to Ishvara, like, you know, Ishvara Pranidhana, if we devote ourselves to Ishvara, not just in this sort of conceptual idea of the Lord, but in the form of Krishna himself, that is the fundamental purpose of yoga. You want to be a really good yoga teacher? You need to be a devotee of Krishna. What is this? Vaishnavism. Now, this is Krishna Bhakti, which happened sometime after Patanjali writing the Yoga Sutra. Not the same. This is a syncretism. Let's mash two things that are really different into one. One of the primary precepts of being a member of ISKCON is the repetition of the Maha Mantra. Like you got to do your Hare Krishnas, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. You got to get that on. That's a big part of the thing. There is nothing in Patanjali that says you got to do bhakti. You got to do devotional practice. No. In fact, you could make a case, I think, for it being the opposite. So again, here's another. So if my first anecdote was about people doing unethical bullshit marketing, my second anecdote is about people mashing stuff together that's actually contradictory in order to pursue their own goals. And what really pisses me off about this, Amy, don't forget to tick the foul language box, is that the people who are consuming this shit don't know. If you offer a yoga teacher training and you say, hey, you need a copy of the Yoga Sutra, how do you know whose version they're bringing to your training unless you state it quite clearly? How do you know what the translator or more the interpreter of the particular translator, right? Because they might not be in an original translation. Like the Radiant Sutra, it's a pretty far derivation from the original text, and I know like six Sanskrit words. I still know that. People don't know. If we're not being transparent here, people don't know that they're not the same thing. And again, here are active practitioners, potentially. I don't know. I've never met this guy. I'm only going off Nicole's research. But it seems to me in reading her book that this is a bit of a long bow to draw, and whether it's just misleading or it's intentionally manipulative, I don't know. I can't call it. Don't have enough information. Either way, it's syncretism that intentionally bringing these two things together that probably don't belong together, and people who perceive it or receive it for the first time are not going to be able to tell the difference. And I think that's bullshit. That is anecdote, bullshit anecdote. DR, number two for today. Let's move on. The next thing that's given me the downright shits in Yogaland and the third quarter of why Amy is taking a season break is this bloody consumerism and flat out intense money making in the yoga industry. Now, obviously, I got a business based in Yogaland. I'm cashing in on all your yoga stuff. I'm here. I'm part of it. But at what point is it okay? And what point is it gross? I'm going to write about these more substantially in some blogs over the coming weeks. But there's two things here. The first one is, of course, the purchase of Yoga International by Gaia TV. And I'll put the press release. Hang on, I've got to keep a note of the episode notes I'm telling you all about. Press release in the episode notes. And if you want the full blow-by-blow, I can't recommend enough the most recent Conspirituality podcast episode on this. They go into a whole bunch of detail. I listened to it like twice back-to-back just to squeeze the juice from it. But I'm reading now from the press release. This was issued on the 22nd of December, 2021. Okay, Yoga International, Gaia Inc., a subscription video streaming service dedicated to conscious media and serving global conscious community, acquired Yoga International today. Yoga International is considered the authentic voice of yoga in the West. Originally started as a print magazine 30 years ago by the Himalayan Institute, Yoga International has since transformed into a digital-only platform and community with paid subscribers around the world. This acquisition adds 4,000 hours of unique content to Gaia's library, and you can click the link to go on and read the full press release. I'm not going to go into all of the detail. You should go listen to the Conspirituality podcast on this topic to get the detail. Suffice it to say, Gaia TV hosts content that's highly problematic. Anti-vax, pseudoscience, some big names in air quotes, wellness that are dubious at best, grifters at worst. There is some whacked out shit on that channel, and now the money that you make or spend on Yoga International is associated with Gaia. And so this I was talking to a friend of mine who has my interest in Yoga International. At this point, I'm paying $2 Australian a month for streaming service. I keep going to withdraw my membership. They keep saying, do you want a little bit more for another dollar? And by the time they bill me, it's $2 Australian, and what the hell, why not? I got to tell you, I'm not paying anymore because for me personally, I don't want any of my money, $2 or otherwise, going to a platform that disseminates misinformation. Not up for it. But that's not going to be the same for everybody. And I have clients who have spent hours and hours and hours and hours and hours making content to offer on the Yoga International platform. I've got friends who have content on that platform and make part of their income by a percentage of the monthly memberships that they receive from people having signed up through their unique link. They get an affiliate payment every month. It's an important part of their business. My teacher announced last week that he's going to be offering a series of live streaming classes on the platform, still actively engaged in it. Like I said, my choice, not giving them any more money. Bummed, because that's where my teacher's content is. Luckily, there are other ways to get it, and I'm going to go pursue those. But all of this to say, for anecdote number 3 of 4, it just feels like things are getting incredibly complicated. You know, you can't just buy a thing anymore and trust that it's going to be okay. And let's face it, that's probably a good thing, but it can also just feel really heavy, don't you think? Like sometimes you just want to go do something or buy something and not have to do so much research and duty of care and due diligence to make sure that everything is okay. I remember, again, I'm going to turn this into a blog post, so if you want more, it's coming. I remember being at the Bali Spirit Festival. I think it was 2013. And there was a yoga teacher there. I won't, again, I'm not going to call her out, but I just, Anusara had just blown up. So I was very recently at the other end of the Anusara movement and sort of reeling and bummed and pissed off and upset at people and a bit uncertain about where I was going next because I'd just started my, I'd done all of the immersions and I was just ready to, just done the first weekend of the full out teacher training. And so I was a bit like, well, what now? But there was all of these Anusara superstars still hanging around and one of them was at the Bali Spirit Festival. And so I was like, yeah, bring it. I've been watching her for a while. This is great. I finally get to go sit at her feet. Fantastic. Get to the class. She had someone, at least I can definitely remember one. It could have been more than one playing drums, not tabla, like djembe, right? Some dude on a djembe and we're all sat there on our mats. And she has us doing this kind of shoulder shrug in time with the djembe. And I thought, okay, this is where she's going to chat to us, give us the Anusara philosophy sandwich, and then teach us some asana and give us a bit more. And off we go, great, I got this. But the shrugging and the drumming just kept going. And that formed the whole class. That was it, just shoulder. I guess it, you know, I'm doing it now. Can you tell? Bouncing. Actually feels quite nice and it's probably nice and loosens up your body. It's probably good for your shoulder flossing. But I got to tell you, 60 minutes of it, yeah, I've flown a fair ways to get here. I could have done this at home. Wasn't the best class I've been to, let's just say. But here's the reason why I raise it. During the shoulders and the drumming and whatever, I think there might have been breathing synced up. Can't remember. She's chatting. And she gets to chatting about sustainability. And I'm thinking, oh, rock on. This is my background. You know, that's what I did before I became a coach. I was into all of that caper, done all of those sorts of, all that sort of stuff until I had, you know, climate change, compassion fatigue, and then I just couldn't do it anymore. Do some yoga instead. Guess what? Time's ticking on that front, it would seem. She starts talking about sustainability and she says to us all that we should all actually have a sustainable yoga mat. And I think back then I hadn't been long out of my teacher training. I don't know if I'd actually ever spent much money on a yoga mat. I probably still had my Kmart yoga mat, $12, who knows, made out of petrol, you know, dead dinosaur yoga mat for sure. And I'm thinking, oh, she's probably right. This is probably, you know, not great. It's made out of fossil fuels, whatever. So she says to us all, you know, you should go to the, what do they call it? The marketplace, you know, where everybody's got the stalls selling all the shit. You should go to the marketplace straight after this class, buy yourself a sustainable yoga mat. I don't know who at the time she was a brand rep for. Maybe they had a stand at the marketplace. I don't know. I wasn't that informed. I wasn't connecting those dots. It was nearly 10 years ago, whatever. I'm much more cynical now. Anyway, so she's, but this is the bit that really gave me the shits. And if I wasn't so codependent, I would have stood up and left. If it happened now, you better fucking believe it. I'm out of there. And then I'm tweeting about it. Okay. So then she says, and once you've bought your sustainable yoga mat, bring your old yoga mat back to me and I'll donate it to orphans. Holy shit. You know when you just have those moments, like it's the full face palm, but it's not just a face palm moment, like the head lowers to the hand. The hand doesn't come to the head lowers to the hand, face palm. It's like all is lost. It's Arjuna in the chariot. Krishna, mate, all is lost. I just can't do this. This chick has just told me that to save the planet, I need to go buy more shit and then I need to give my toxic shit to orphans. What the actual hell? Shanti, shanti, shanti here, right? So again, in the past week, all of this chat, all of this like what the hell do I do now? Do I talk about Yoga International? Do I just quietly cancel my membership? What about my friends when they ask, what are we doing here? Makes me unpack what other ways is money getting channeled into bullshit? What have I seen? What am I doing myself? What's my role in all of this consumerism and yoga? Again, these are not, I have no answers this time. This is just all the stuff that's floating around and floating around in the forest, floating around in the the zeitgeist. You know, this is what's happening right now in yoga land, which of course brings me to anecdote number four. I don't know if, trigger warning, I'm going to be talking about abuses of power. So, you know, check out, join me back up here in, I don't know, 3-4 minutes. If that's not for you, if you need to take care of yourself and avoid that. So if you're anything like me, you've probably been reading some of the stuff around para yoga. I'm on Rod Stryker's mailing list and so received his apology letter a few months ago now. I've got former clients and colleagues in the para yoga community, and I've just kind of been keeping an eye on what's going on there, given, like I said before, that I was heavily invested in my Anusara yoga teacher training journey back in 2012 when that whole thing blew up also. So just this is not where I say this is what I think someone else should do, but this is where I do say I have experience having had a primary teacher. Although I wasn't directly learning from John, I think I went to maybe, I don't know, a couple of weekend trainings that he taught in a huge room of people. He wouldn't know who I was. But I do know what it's like to go, holy shit, I thought I was in this thing and now I don't know what to do because I liked the thing. I really liked the thing and I really liked the community, but it's not the same anymore. What do I do? So I've kind of just been keeping a bit of a watching eye out for that, what's happening over there. And then I'm also currently studying with somebody who I've studied with before, both online and in person. And it's a teacher that I trust. It's not my primary teacher by any means, but it is a nice supplement to what I like to learn about and where my personal practice is moving. And last week I heard some content from someone else who I really trust and look up to, you know, trash talking the person that I'm currently studying with and trash talking them in a way that suggested there was a potential boundary violation, if not currently happening, then certainly imminent. And I'm a, you know, I'd like to think, just not, unlike how I was in 2013 at the Bali Spirit Festival, sitting there thinking about poisoning orphans with trashy yoga mats, I didn't just, you know, I'm not just going to sit around anymore when I see this sort of thing happening to myself. At least I hope not, if I can see it happening to myself. I'm fairly discerning at this point. So I'm not, but it's still just even the fact that it's raised and that a place that I thought was okay, someone else that I also trusted, maybe it's not okay. I am again left in this question. I don't know, it feels okay to me, but Anusara felt okay to me, or it feels okay to me, but I mean, I did a bit of stuff with the Kadampa, what are they called? TKM, New Kadampa Movement. I did residential stuff with them. I was into it. And you better believe that's a cult, you know, like, yowie. I thought that was okay at the time. Although when that nun told me that she didn't do yoga because doing yoga would mean she was too attached to her physical body, I did remember thinking, that sounds a little like bullshit. I think you still need to be able to sit. And I remember meeting a nun once. The second yoga retreat I ever taught in Thailand had some nuns from Ladakh. I won't name, that. Well, you can probably guess, they were part of quite a large religious institution in that area. You can probably guess whose convent they were in. Anyway, whatever. This one woman, and she was she'd been a nun for forever, and she was still a young woman, and she was moving up the hierarchy, and she had ambition for her career in that space, as well as obviously her own practice, yada yada. But you know, she was going places. Except she had, like, she showed me her X-rays. She'd brought them with her for me to look at. Help me, please. Like, I can. If anybody brings out their X-rays, be aware of what your training actually is. Don't overstep your bloody training. But it didn't take much looking at this woman's X-rays to see that her spine was, I could see from looking at the X-rays that it was no joke that she couldn't sit to meditate because it would have caused her a lot of pain. You know, there was some stuff going on with her spine. And this woman was at risk her career, and by career, I mean like also her her deep devotional life, the way that she knew it was at risk because she simply couldn't sit to meditate, right? Like, anyway, so she wanted to, this does kind of loop us back. She wanted to learn more yoga from me so that she could take care of her body, so that she could meditate. She was not attached to her body. It was impediment to her practice that she needed to overcome, and that looked like doing some yoga. Anyway, that's that. Let's loop us back. So I went out to Thailand. Let's come back to Kadampa. Amy meeting a nun who told her that yoga was nice until you actually wanted to get really, if you really wanted to pursue your practicing, you need to just drop any attachment to the body, which brings us back to Kadampa, which brings us back to Amy not always knowing that she's in some bullshit. But right now I feel okay with what I'm learning. I think it's a teacher that's been endorsed by other third parties that I trust. And yet someone else that I trust is saying, hang on, maybe potentially alarm bells. So here again, my fourth anecdote for today. It's just like where the hell do you know where to turn when it comes to your teachers, let alone your gurus? Like influencers and gurus, I think we just need to call it done for the most part on that, because just as soon as you identify with an influencer, you know, like they get into strife. Anybody, just love to anybody who was a Rachel Hollis fan, right? I've got someone in my life who was massively into Rachel Hollis, massively flew over the world to go to things, stayed up overnight because of the time zones to do the online conferences, bought the stuff, the books, the watched the daily pod, the video, what, all of it. And then, you know, bippity boppity boo, and Rachel Hollis is now sort of cancelled, right? So whether it's an influencer or a guru, maybe just know more of them. And maybe even with our teachers, this is a zero answers podcast episode. It's simply about feeling kind of a little bit overwhelmed about the current state of affairs in Yogaland. So let me I'm going to finish this up with a reading from one of my favorite texts, and also actually maybe two bits of stuff to read. But before, I'll just recap on the anecdotes. And again, I know this has been an interesting episode. So here are my four current anecdotes from the forest. Bullshit and unethical marketing. Underhanded, sneaky marketing. Not asteya, steya. Not ahimsa, himsa. Bad shit. I am done with it. It makes me feel sick, and it makes me very angry that people who claim to be practitioners of yoga do this crap. Two, oblivious or orchestrated syncretism that is misleading at best and manipulative at worst, mashing stuff together that is arguably opposing in order to pursue some kind of vested interest. Not okay. Not everything has to be mashed together. You're allowed to do more than one thing at a time. They get to be different. But misleading people who simply don't know better, particularly when you're talking about complex ideas, again, it's unethical, and it's giving me the shits. Number three, consumerism and where your money goes in yoga. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if you're currently teaching on Yoga International, or send them money, or I don't know, maybe you're actually a Gaia TV person and you can't get enough Joe Dispenza. I used to be into Joe Dispenza before I kind of thought about it. That first book, it's all covered in marks in the margins. And the coach that I used to work with, she's hard for it right now. So, you know, but I do think we need to think about how much stuff you're buying. Do you really need it? Is what you got okay? Does it have to be fancy? And if you're buying stuff, what are you doing with the old stuff? You know, where is your money going? Who owns the company? Who's benefiting from the purchase? you know, just a bit more mindfulness. I just don't, I mean, like I said, I make good money from you all, from Yoga Land. I'm not saying don't make money. I'm not saying that yoga can't, I mean, this day and age, and I'll get to this, a great passage in a minute, they're not the same thing. They're not, so pre-modern yoga and modern yoga, they're not the same thing. So it's not unethical to make money from yoga. The opposite. If the money is made in an ethical way, dharma artha, right? Like, go make money. Just don't be a C-word about it. Sorry if that's too much for the pod, but it's the end of the season. Going out with a bang. Number four, just no more gurus. No more gurus, no more influencers. Watch your own parasocial relationships. One of my friends was telling me for the first time ever, she got stopped in the supermarket with, oh my God, are you such and such? I do your classes on YouTube. And how she had some conflicting emotions as a result of that. People think they know you, or you think you know people because you're consuming their content on the regular. We don't know each other. We don't know each other. I was going to tell you a little bit more about my Rod Stryker, personal Rod Stryker connections. I'm not going to do that, but let's just, I mean, I've met the guy, we've spoken. I didn't know, I wouldn't have guessed any of that. Like, I've got the Four Desires on my bookshelf. I enjoyed it as a read. What do I do now? Throw it out? I don't know. It's really confusing. And the teacher that I'm studying with at the minute, maybe I need to do a bit more research. I thought I knew where he was coming from. Is that okay? I thought I was down with it. Maybe it's not. Who knows? Who knows? But we need to just be so, not skeptical in a cynical way, but just eyes wide open with who we're learning from. And that includes me. Just because I say something, I'm just some chick sat at home with her dog snoring and barking at the same time. The dog, I'm not barking. Well, I guess I kind of am. But, you know, that. All right, so what? Well, here's, I want to read two more. Again, these are little beeges. These are just sort of seeds that I'm going to dig into more in blogs and bonus episodes in the coming couple of months, really feeling the desire to slow down and go deeper into some stuff. But this is from a great academic article, episode notes. Go read the whole thing. It's called From Patanjali to the Gospel of Sweat Love. This aesthetic anti-market movement that started in India, they're talking about yoga, that started in India and arrived in earnest on American shores in 1893, that was with, Vivekananda, came to be at the center of an $80 billion global market in 2016, one-fifth of which was in the United States. This is remarkable because, inspired by Hindu philosophy, the yoga movement's central codes were meant to provide an antidote to the individualism and consumerism fostered by capitalism, aiming to free one from all worldly material considerations. They're quoting Vivekananda, 1947. That's the first kind of book. Go listen to the Patreon bonus about the history of yoga if you want to know more about that. They go on. Eventually, the movement was cleansed of its anti-materialist essence. Don't you love that phrase? That was editor insertion. And market-encumbering religious constraints. Let me read that again. Eventually, the movement, yoga, was cleansed of its anti-materialist essence and market-encumbering religious constraints. A meditative and spiritual practice with the ultimate aims of self-diminution, ego transcendence, and union with the divine was transformed into a certifiable, priceable, and user-friendly product with different proprietary versions promising a positive body image, fitness, and stress relief that could be bought and sold in the market. Yeah, that's where we're at now. And I'm thinking we should probably do this as a future book club, Patreon book club, but I think it would be good if you haven't read it yet. I recommend Selling Yoga from Counterculture to Pop Culture by Andrea Jane is also a good reference if you want more on this stuff. So, you know, in reading this article, they're right. That yoga now, or as Andrea would say it in her book Selling Yoga, pre-modern yoga, which is all of that stuff. Hang on, let me go back to the quote. meditative and spiritual practice with the ultimate aims of self-diminution, ego transcendence, and union with the divine, i.e. what Patanjali talks about in the Yoga Sutra, 400 CE, pre-modern yoga and modern yoga, aka positive body image, fitness, stress relief that can be bought and sold in the market, not the same thing. Just not. There is no clear through line. They aren't directly connected. They are different things. They borrow from each other, but they are wildly different things. So in a way, I find this heartening, because if I look at these four anecdotes from the forest, if there was a strong through line from one to the other, I would be devastated at how unraveled something so potent had become. But if we accept, in fact, that they're not the same thing, it is heartening to a degree, because I can now approach these four points less as indicators of my spiritual tradition's integrity and more in terms of my industry's integrity. And for me, that feels less charged. It feels less fraught, knowing that I might be in an industry that has some really shitty operators and some underhanded practices and some obscure or manipulative techniques and approaches. I can handle that. I think every industry has that, right? That's not good, but it's true, which helps me sleep better at night. So then I guess I want to finish with, to finish the season and to finish this somewhat odd and eclectic episode, I want to finish with a passage from David Gordon White's book, The Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, A Biography, another one that I think we should read in our book club. And in fact, you can get it on Audible and it's great. It's a great listen. It's a really good book. So he's talking about the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, but rather as a biography. So as in the history of the text and situating the text in time and scholarly context, rather than actually just interpreting what the text is trying to say. There's a load of those sorts of commentary type books. This is a biography and it's great. So David Gordon White, The Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, A Biography. I'll put the link in the episode notes. He says, yoga, air quotes, yoga has a wider range of meanings than nearly any other word in the entire Sanskrit lexicon. The act of yoking an animal, as well as the yoke itself, is called yoga. In astronomy, a conjunction of planets or stars, as well as a constellation, is called yoga. When one mixes together various substances, that too can be called yoga. The word yoga has also been employed to denote a device, a recipe, a method, a strategy, a charm, an incantation, fraud, a trick, an endeavor, a combination, union, an arrangement, zeal, care, diligence, industriousness, discipline, use, application, contact, a sum total, and the work of alchemists. He goes on to say, but this is by no means an exhaustive list. So here's where I'm going to finish this long, strange episode and, in fact, season. There is some weird and wacky shit happening right now in yoga land, and it feels to me like it's at a crescendo. It might go bigger. In fact, I suspect it will. But it does seem to be at a new fever pitch. Let's agree, well, my invitation is for us to agree that pre-modern yoga and modern postural yoga are different things, and there's great things in both. And that it's okay that bad business practices happen in our industry, and there are processes for them to be called out and hopefully mitigated, resolved, apologized for, etc. It doesn't mean that what you may hold true as your spiritual touchstone is also at risk in that same way. Now, obviously, all of this is with caveats. Like if you're learning from a manipulative guru and he's teaching you some bullshit, then that's a whole other story. But if, like me, you got a strange DM that someone's hacked your account and is feeding on your followers and calling themselves yoginis, That doesn't mean that yoga is trash. That just means someone in yoga is doing a little bit of trash stuff. So then I want to leave you with this consideration. Based on that fun quote from White, again, that's from his biography of the Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, what does yoga mean to you? This many years on, this many strange eddies and cul-de-sacs and oubliettes and pathways. Maybe you've walked some odd ones yourself. Maybe you've gone down one and, whoa, hang on, not that one, and ended up at another. Maybe you've pursued one only to have it shut down for one reason or another. What does yoga mean to you? What does yoga mean in your life? What does yoga mean in your business in 2022 and beyond? Thank you, as always, for listening to the Abundant Yoga Teacher podcast. I thank you again for indulging me in a random collection of thoughts for our final episode for the season. I'm going to take a couple of weeks off, but go hit some options if you want more stuff. Option number one, there are hundreds of episodes of the Abundant Yoga Teacher podcast. I think you can only get 100 on Apple, but that just rolls. So if you want to go back through some of the old stuff, if you're a fairly recent listener, head over to my website and just click on that. It's amymcdonald.com.au. Click on the podcast tab and like have at it. There's loads there. If you want even more, you probably need, addiction support perhaps. Anyway, if you want even more, there are even more on the Patreon page. So that's $5 a month. We'll get you access to all of those. And look, if you want, you can just go sign up now, smash it out, pay me $5 and then cancel. There's like, six now, I think. And I'm working on some more substantial ones, kind of building on a lot of what I covered today. So be on the lookout for those if you want that. And then finally, as I said at the top, you've got to get your Keep Growing Mastermind registrations in today, tomorrow at the very least, but it'd be better if you didn't have to rush so much because there's a couple of things to do before we have our very first group coaching call for the year this coming Wednesday morning, Sydney, Melbourne, Canberra, Brisbane time, Australian East Coast time. So the link again, finally, episode notes. Thank you again. I'll see you all in a couple of weeks. Namaste. So there you have it, folks, another edition of the Abundant Yoga Teacher podcast. Hey, favour to ask, if you found the content useful, I would be very grateful if you could support this podcast by giving me a 5-star rating. And if you've got a moment, a review would be super cool. No pressure, of course. Like I said earlier, if you have any suggestions for podcast topics in the future, I would love to be in service. DM me on Instagram @AmyYogaBizCoach. Take deep care.